It's a great pleasure, to, I think, meet you for the first time, perhaps,
Yes.
and certainly have a chance to get to know you a little bit. Your name is a legend, of course, in Cambridge, and many of our students have read your books. But I wondered whether we could just start with perhaps your family background and
Yes.
father, ancestors,
Yes,
and
yes.
something about that.
Yes. Well, I come from a very intellectual family. My grandfather was a writer in Salonika. He edited a newspaper in Salonika called Gonjiyede. And one of my uncles, Ahmet Emin Yalman, was a very famous journalist working in the 1900s, 1910, from 1910 until 1975 or so, 50, 60 years, fighting for freedom of the press, liberty, free democratic institutions in Turkey. I was born in Istanbul and into this family with this tradition of, very strong tradition of commitment to political liberty, beginning with the Ottoman Empire, but then going on to the Turkish Republic. And when I was born, it was a time when the Cultural Revolution in Turkey was still very fresh. I recall my grandmother trying to learn the new Latin alphabet, trying to switch over from the old Ottoman script to the new alphabet, but making headway and making sure that she could read the newspapers every day. And my dear uncle used to write literally rivers of editorials every day, which were then read by my aunt to my grandfather every morning. And I would often sit on his lap and listen to this. So I come from that sort of background. And I went to a very good American school in Istanbul called Robert College, very still going on and still a very impressive school. I'm now one of the trustees of that school. At that school, there were a number of wonderful Englishmen. One was Philip Alliot, who had been a fellow of Peterhouse, and he took a liking to me. He was a wonderful man, an extremely gifted teacher of biology. He had been a fellow of Peterhouse and he'd given up his fellowship and had come to teach at that school. I don't know quite what motivated him to do that, but there were some others. There was Hilary Sumner Boyd from Christchurch, Oxford, who was half American, but also highly gifted and intellectual. And these two people had a very profound effect on me as I was growing up. And it was Philip Alliot's recommendation through
How do you
his
spell his name?
Alliot.
Alliot.
No. Ullyot or UL, I think it was double L. His very close friend was Lawrence Pickin. And Philip Alliot and Lawrence Pickin got me into Peterhouse. In those days, it would have been very difficult for a Turk going through the Turkish schooling system to take the exams in Latin and Greek or whatever it was and get through into Cambridge. So somehow these two managed to get the hurdles lifted. And I came to Peterhouse and had an absolutely a time of true enlightenment. It was just delightful to be in Cambridge for.
What date was this?
This was 1950.
As we
Sep
pass
September, September 1950, Michaelmas term.
As we pass names, sometimes it's a good idea to stop. Since we've interviewed Lawrence Pickin.
Yes. Oh, you did.
Yes.
I'm happy to hear that.
And so what sort of man was Lawrence? I mean, he was an expert on Turkish music, of course.
Yes. Well, he was one of these legendary scholars. Again, a person of the most admirable qualities. He was originally a cell biologist. That's why he was a friend of Philip Olliott, who was also a biologist. He had gone on then to teach himself Chinese. So he was on the faculty of biology, natural sciences, or whatever it was called at that time. Because of his Chinese connections, he was in the faculty of Oriental languages, and he was also a wonderful musician, so he was also on the faculty of music, and he spoke Turkish as well, so altogether a most wonderful man. He'd always been a bachelor, never married, I believe. Had in his youth these travels through Turkey and had fallen in love with Turkish culture and traced it all the way into Central Asia and had intriguing theories about the way Asian music had traveled east and west. And he had some theories, which I haven't really looked into, theories of connections between Japanese court music, gagaku, the famous gagaku music, and the music of Anatolia, Central Asia and Anatolia. So, very intriguing. Anyway, he had taken a great liking to me, and when I came to Cambridge, he was one of the people who welcomed me here and said to me that if I had any problems that I should go and see him and so on. But I never did have any problems, so it was all as well.
What did you come to read?
I came, I was, because of my interest in politics and freedom and society and these changes in Turkey, I really wanted to understand how it was that societies worked and what it was that led an ancient society like the Ottoman Empire and Turkey to have a cultural revolution that was so profound and so thoroughgoing, a revolution in which a script that had been used for the last 1,000 years had suddenly overnight been switched over to the Latin script and so on. And I wanted to understand that, and I really wanted to therefore study history, social sciences and so on. My tutors said that I had been accepted for anthropology, archaeology and anthropology, so they said that I should go on with that. So we started off.
Was this Graham Clark, or who was the people's tutor?
I think it was Dennis MacSmith, the historian.
Yeah.
And he thought it probably was safer. He was a historian, and he thought that it was safer to have this exotic type go on with a subject that was a little less demanding, shall we say, at that time. History was supposed to be the most difficult to get into, the history tripos. And so I started with archaeology and anthropology, and I liked it, but I was always interested to try and find my way into political thought, historical thought, and so on. Dennis MacSmith said to me, well, you do this for part one, and then we'll see, we'll decide what to do for part two. At the end of part one, I got a first. That was a great surprise to the college. They didn't expect that. And once I got a first, then I got a scholarship and so on, they said, oh, you can't change now. So we went on after that.
Who were your teachers in that, both either the first year or second year undergraduate level in Cambridge?
Did they
have a striking impression on you?
Well, Jack Goody, of course. And
who was teaching you?
he was a graduate student.
I see.
And so was Kathleen Goff, and so was Ray Smith.
Yes.
They were all graduate students, and I was an undergraduate. And as I think I was telling you earlier, the first day I came to Cambridge, my first few days outside Turkey at the age of 19, 20, I decided to go down to London to see what the big city was like. So I went to the train station, and I was walking along the platform, deciding which compartment to go into, and I saw a very attractive woman sitting in one of the compartments. So I promptly went in and sat opposite her. This lady turned out to be Kathleen Goff. And we started up a conversation. She saw the book I was reading, which was The Newer. And she started up the conversation, and then she became my supervisor. So she was my first supervisor in Cambridge. Maya Fortis hemmed and hawed first as to whether a graduate student should be my supervisor. He was perhaps thinking that might be Gwilym Jones or Rio Fortune or someone like that might be more appropriate. But Kathleen was wonderful. And then,
what sort of person was she? She influenced you later also in relation to your work on kinship in India.
Yes, yes.
But as a person, everyone says she's very beautiful, but was she a very
she
nice
was
person as well?
Extremely nice, very full of enthusiasms. At that time, I think she had just divorced her husband, with whom she had been in India. She was always full of stories of great amusement as far as these curious customs of the Nayar and the Brahmin, the Nambudiri Brahmin in South India were concerned. She was very open-minded, but she was also very intrigued by all that had gone on. She came from a family in the north found herself in Cambridge in a society in which she didn't feel entirely comfortable. And so the psychological element was quite uppermost in her mind. And I think it was that tension between her background from the north, a modest family, I think, in the north, and her situation in an intellectually exciting and important place like Cambridge. That tension, I think, led her further into subjects of psychological analysis. And so her take on India, South India, the Nayar Nambudiri matter, took her further and further in the direction of psychoanalytic theories. And I was at the time myself very interested in psychoanalysis, so that was another bond between us, because at that time I thought that, you know, some of the problems in Turkey could be understood by a combination of psychology, psychological theorizing, and sociological theorizing. I've come to believe that politics doesn't lend itself very easily to psychological analysis, in fact, that the sociological parts, anthropological parts, are much more important. But at that time, in any case, this was a nice bond between us, and we explored all sorts of theories and ideas. And it was a matter of immense enthusiasm on the part of Kathleen Goff, Jack Goody.
What was the young Jack Goody like? He's another person we've interviewed as a teacher. I mean, you know, he's got a fantastic range and width of mind.
Yes, yes.
But in spoken language, he sometimes hesitates between various options.
But he was such a warm and gentle and decent and open human being. And that came through loud and clear in all his relations. There was a way in which he could bring out the best in people. And I think that has been true for Jack Goody all his life. He has been able to generate the best out of people, and that was an aspect of his character which I found extremely attractive and very charming. And so I was very, very fortunate. I mean, you know, it's the kind of intellectual direction that one would want anyone to have. It was simply delightful. Meyer Fortes had just come, and he also was full of enthusiasm. He was having difficulties with Ethel Lindgren,
yes,
and with Rio Fortune.
Yes.
Rio Fortune was going through one of his really difficult periods in which he had great difficulty communicating with people. And so he was in and out of the department, and I think Meyer didn't know quite what to make of him and how to handle him. I have later come to realize what a remarkable history he had behind him with his travels from New Zealand with Margaret Mead, Gregory Bateson, and so on. But at that time, of course, I was totally unaware of all of that. And Ethel Lindgren was working especially with a wonderful, another wonderful graduate student at the time, Raith Bulmer. Dear Raith Bulmer, a man of, again, immense charm and enthusiasm and interest, of very wide interests. He was interested in the biological aspects of social cohesion. He had been much influenced by the work of Tinbergen, and he was always telling us stories about penguins and fishes and other creatures who have family lives and so on. And he was very intrigued by the way some of these ideas could be carried over to his work among Lapps in northern Sweden and Norway. So Meyer...
was Meyer... we've got a film of him lecturing on divination.
Yes.
No interview with him.
Yes.
I knew him in late in his life as a very, very delightful, kind,
yes,
charming man.
Yes.
Was that your impression of
him? That was my impression too. When I told him of my interests in, you know, with Kathleen Goff about psychology and the influence of Freud on social matters, he discouraged me. He said, no, even though he himself was a psychologist, he said, no, don't go in that direction. That first you must understand Durkheim and Weber. First, the social elements come first. He was not a very good lecturer. He was a very hesitant lecturer. But he was a very warm human being. And so in seminars, he was really very good. We would have these wonderful seminars at which the graduate students and the undergraduates would get together, and there were perhaps 20, 30 of us around a large table in the department. I think it was every Wednesday afternoon. And we would work on a particular topic. I do remember that the first or second year we worked for a long time on kinship systems of Australia, which was a real eye-opener. And it was wonderful to have the exchanges between the more experienced graduate students and Meyer, and the contributions of very interested undergraduates to these topics. So these were periods of immense intellectual vivacity.
And then you'd go off to the bun shop, is that correct?
Yes. After the seminars, we'd go to the bun shop and have mild and bitters and so on, and get on with discussions. Mm. Evans Pritchard, I used to run the anthropology club, and one of the highlights was the visit of Evans Pritchard, who also was a very gentle person. at least towards the undergraduates, he was gentle. I'm not sure that he was all that very gentle with his colleagues. But what I do remember about Evans Pritchard was the totally offhanded way he treated the occasion to which he had been invited, in the sense that he came and gave a lecture in which he literally started in the middle of a sentence that he had been writing and went on reading what he had been writing for about 45 minutes and then ended in the middle of a paragraph, just like that, and left the rest of us wondering as to what this had been all about, because there was very little explanation as to what he was up to. I think at that time he was working on those lectures that he gave on the BBC, the Reith lectures, I believe. But I do remember that we couldn't make head or tail of it. At a later occasion, we had a visit by Lévi-Strauss, Claude Lévi-Strauss. And some of us had been reading Lévi-Strauss. We had a wonderful, another one of the graduate students was Derek Stenning, who worked among the Fulani. And he made a presentation of Lévi-Strauss's Les formes élémentaires de la vie religieuse. Les formes de la parenté. Les formes élémentaires de la parenté. I think that's the title. And Meyer poo-pooed it, said that it was totally irrelevant and not very significant, unimportant work. Yeah. It has not turned out to be so, actually. But I do remember that was the first sort of take on this very seminal work in our group, which has always reminded me of how easy it is to mistake really significant works to be less than what they are. Later, I think it was my first year as a graduate student.
So you, just to finish, you got a 2-1 or?
For part two,
yes.
There were four of us who were sort of at the head of the group, and I got a 2-1 in the part two of the tripos. I think Jean Lafontaine got a first.
I was going to just ask about Jean, because she's another person we've talked to about this.
Yes.
Which Jack interviewed. What was the young Jean Lafontaine like? She's from a colonial background, wasn't she?
Yes, she was from East Africa, but her family had very strong connections with Istanbul, with Turkey. And so Jean and I were very close friends, and I was extremely fond of her. We used to go to May balls and things together. And would work together were sort of challenging each other in the work we were doing in anthropology. There was another woman, Anne, I can't remember her family name now, who also got a first. She was from Hungary and was very facile in the way she wrote. She wrote rather well. And Maya was very impressed by her. So those two, I think, the two ladies got the firsts at that time. And myself and Anthony Forge.
Oh, yes. Ray Smith, or you said he was a graduate student?
Ray was already a graduate student. Southwold.
Martin Southwold.
We were the ones who were challenging these ladies. Then in my first year as a graduate student, Maya wanted to make a change in the department, so somehow he induced Ethel Lindgren to leave, and her position was then filled by Edmund Leach.
And this was about 1950.
54. Yes. Edmund came and gave a lecture, and we analyzed. Oh, he also took part in a seminar, and I remember analyzing and criticizing the political systems of Highland Burma rather severely. He got very angry and stormed out of the room. He had a very strong spirit. But,
you had analyzed it severely, all that the yes. group had, yes.
Well, I had too. I was the one responsible. But then we became very good friends. And he had been a reader in London, and he took a lectureship here to come to Cambridge. And he and I were both very interested in Lévi-Strauss and the work that was being done in France. And so over time, we became closer and closer friends. And we were both extremely interested in the whole question of the structure of consciousness and the structure, the organization of symbolism and consciousness. And we thought that this was one way in which this whole matter of social structures could be traced into the problem of the structure of consciousness in the mind and the relationship between symbolic forms and structures of consciousness could be related. And we thought that this was one way in which the whole question of ritual symbolism in religion and so on could be investigated and analyzed. And that was very exciting and challenging. So in many seminars, I remember, we pursued some of these issues. Edmund Leach was a very a striking person, a man of extraordinary intelligence and perceptiveness. And he had a sense of the need to establish contrasts, difference. He was very concerned to take the opposite point of view from whatever was being promoted. And in that clash, one usually went a sort of thesis, antithesis, synthesis sort of dialectic in new directions. And so he was extremely challenging in that way. But I think that attitude of questioning issues all the time in every seminar got on Maya Fortis's nerves. And so as time went on, regrettably, the relations between them became more and more distant. They were always cordial, but they became less and less nice towards each other in private.
Mm. From what date was that? While you were still a graduate student?
Yes. It started rather early, but it went on and became rather a bitter matter, actually, in their relations, especially once Edmund Leach was promoted to become a professor and then provost of King's, and Maya Fortis was a fellow of King's. Mm. The relationship became quite distant, regrettably.
I mean, it was obviously a personality clash, but also theoretical clash between...
As well.
Yes, structural functionalism and structuralism.
Yes.
And also an area clash between
Africa and Asia.
Yes.
All of those were involved. Mm. All of those were involved. But most importantly, I think it was also a clash between a South African Jew who felt somewhat alienated in the society in Cambridge. Towards someone who was seen as a member of the upper classes in Britain. So that was there was that element in
which is what Edmund drew attention to in
his
son Maya.
Yes.
What was the relation between Jack Goody and obviously he got on very well with Maya, but with Edmund?
Very well. Edmund liked Jack very much because of that unusual quality that he has, whereby he can bring out the best in people. He brought out the best in Edmund Leach as well, and so there was always a very good relationship there. Jack was always very fair. In things had to be managed in these seminars because Maya Fortis and Edmund Leach would go at each other hammer and tongs, and Jack was very adept at managing and controlling the level of tension and making very fair comments, which really was very helpful, very helpful, very important.
Had Stanley Tambaya joined the department by that time?
No. Stanley came much later. I met him in when I was working in Sri Lanka. I thought originally that I would go to Central Asia, where I thought, since I knew Turkish, it would be easier to learn the languages and work there. Then the more I looked into the matter, these were of course the days of the Cold War, it looked very difficult to get into Central Asia. The parts where Turkish was spoken were, we might have found some groups in northern Ladakh. There had been some, I think, Kyrgyz or Uyghur groups who had come over as a result of the revolution in China, but they were small, meager groups, and it looked increasingly unlikely that useful fieldwork could be done there. So Edmund had, at that time, made arrangements for himself to go to Sri Lanka. He said to me, to Ceylon at the time. He said to me that, would I like to go to Ceylon and assist in the work to be done there myself? So I thought this was wonderful. I didn't know much about Buddhism, but I was interested in working in a society that was complex and sophisticated and challenging. And so it was the best decision in my life to go there. It was quite a heady affair. Anyway, to go back to Stanley Tambaya, he was a lecturer. He'd just come back. He, I think, graduated from a school from Syracuse University in the United States, and was a lecturer at the University of Ceylon in Peradeniya. And we met, and we hit it off, and I introduced him to Edmund.
Out there or here?
There, in Ceylon. Mm. And then when a position opened up, by that time I was already in America, and when a position opened up here, Edmund invited Tambaya to apply for it and come to Cambridge.
Mm. That was in the early 60s, I
suppose. Yes, early 60s. Yes, that's right. Yes.
Yeah. What was Stanley Tambaya like? We've also interviewed him.
Yes. Well, he had worked in Thailand, he came from a Christian Tamil family in Ceylon. He was very well entrenched in Ceylon, had very good friends, but the Tamil Sinhalese situation there increasingly got more and more difficult. But he was obviously a man of great intellectual vigor, and I think Cambridge suited him extremely well. And he was very happy in Cambridge. I'm not so sure that he's been so happy in the States as in Cambridge, England.
He went to Harvard, did he?
He went, well, okay. The way it worked was this. He was in Cambridge, and I came to Cambridge to spend a year at Clare Hall as I was teaching at the University of Chicago. And since we had my interests in Ceylon were very profound, and I maintained all my friendships, Tambaya and I, of course, were together frequently. So when I returned to Chicago, I started a movement in Chicago to try and get him, get Tambaya to come to Chicago. He had just married an American girl, Mary Wynn, yes, Mary Wynn. So he's very dark, one of the darker Tamils. You know, the Tamils can be very, very dark, and he's one of the darker Tamils. And this girl he had married was very, very blonde, very, very white, so the contrast between them was very striking. In any case, she was an American, came from a distinguished family in America, and I thought that they would be happy in America, that they would like it there in Chicago. So I got the department in Chicago to be interested in Tambi, and they invited him and liked him. But at that time, Harvard was trying to get me to go to Harvard. So as it happened, we couldn't get together in Chicago. I went to Harvard, Tambaya came to Chicago. And once I was in Harvard, I tried to get him to Harvard. So that's how that has that worked, actually. We have been friends ever since. He had a very good effect in Chicago. People liked him very much. He brought his sophistication from Cambridge with the background of the theories of social anthropology here and his knowledge of Thailand and Sri Lanka and India and so on to bear. And so that was all very welcome. Chicago was a very important center for the study of Indian matters, South Asian matters. The South Asian Committee was a lively committee. So he was very popular there.
Turning to your PhD, you were supervised by Edmund Leach for your PhD,
I was first working with Maya Fortes, but then once I started working in Ceylon, and Edmund had spent some time there, and Edmund and I started working together on all these very complex subjects of ritual and religion and symbolism and the ups and downs of Sinhalese Tamil relations and so on. So naturally, I drifted further and further in the direction of Edmund. And also, Edmund, we had, as I said earlier, we shared this interest in the then French approaches to theorizing. And so it was Edmund who was most responsible for the PhD work. I was in Sri Lanka, and we kept a voluminous correspondence, which I keep, which I will pass on to you sometime. Yes, and it is very amusing because it's an amusing correspondence in the sense that it shows how clueless we really were, both of us, because Edmund didn't speak really much Sinhalese. By that time, I was pretty fluent, but I really didn't know too much about the complexities of the extraordinary complexities of Sinhalese mythology and Sinhalese ritual. And I was sort of groping in the dark, trying to figure out how this worked. And it was all still extremely fresh and new. And it was going back on our correspondence, it is really striking of how naive we really were in thinking that we'd be able to come to easy solutions.
Well, what would be interesting, you got his letters to you.
Yes.
And your letters to him will be in the King's College Library.
Yes.
In the archive. And
yes.
The two together.
Yes. Yes. Yes. He used to. He was a wonderful correspondent.
Hmm.
I'm afraid I never was such a good correspondent with my graduate students. He was extremely generous. Hmm. He would write pages and pages and pages on comments on what I had been working on. He became excited by the fact that I discovered a group of people who were very similar in their kinship systems to the Naya, and that whole matrilineal matrilateral kinship system, which at that time existed in eastern Ceylon. Got Maya for Edmund Leach extremely excited.
Mm.
So we had great fun.
Mm. Another person, in case I forget to mention them, because the copy of Under the Boat Tree that I've got with me here is a copy you gave to my former PhD supervisor, Christoph von Führer-Heimendorf.
Oh, yes.
And
dear.
So you must have
yes.
at least met him, did you?
Oh, yes, I met him a number of times, and since I speak quite fluent German.
Mm.
We used to speak German together.
Mm.
And he had taken a liking to me.
Mm.
And he was interested, of course, in India and Indian materials. He'd worked in South India. And so the work I was doing was fun for him.
Mm.
And yes, we met from time to time. I used to go down to London to give seminars.
Mm.
And yes.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
You met Betty.
Yes.
His wife.
Yes.
What was your impression of Christoph? As and some people say that he is a very great ethnographer, but not so much an analytical theorist, etc. He was a very good administrator, built up the service
yes.
department.
Yes.
But as more as a person, what was your impression?
I didn't really know him terribly well. He had spent a lot of time in India, and so the Indian materials were very much on his mind. He didn't know too much about Africa, and so theoretically he was always he was considered rather lightweight by the others, by people like Firth and Leach and others. Didn't take him too seriously, but obviously he was a very considerable ethnographer,
mm.
and wrote all those good books on his work in
mm.
in South India.
Mm.
But I didn't know him terribly well.
Returning to your PhD fieldwork, I often ask whether the person I'm talking to remembers the first moment or the first days or weeks of their arrival in the strange land, that kind of Malinowski moment of landing on the beach and wondering what they're going to make of all this. Do you remember that?
I remember it vividly, yes, indeed. I landed in Colombo. I had been in Istanbul, where the summer had been beautiful. And I landed in Colombo and was walking up and down the seashore, and I saw these huge crabs, really large ones, fighting each other. And I thought, well, we're in for an interesting sort of experience, adventure here. Edmund had made arrangements with a lady called Mrs. Fernando, who was a socialite, a very intelligent person in Colombo. She was a friend of his. And I went to see her. Edmund, by that time, had already gone off into his village. And I wanted to go and see Edmund, to talk to him as to how to proceed. And Mrs. Fernando and I quickly made arrangements for me to buy a second-hand Volkswagen. And I did that. And she arranged also a Tamil cook for me, so that I would have someone to cook for me when I went into my village. And I took this Volkswagen, one of the old types in which you had to double declutch the clutch, a very unusual kind of mechanical contraption, and I drove up to Edmunds Pulelia village. I had no idea what to expect, and it was really utterly fascinating to go to drive through this beautiful countryside with the peasantry all around, people working in their fields and so on. This was September, October, and the rains had come, it was raining very hard, and I had to veer off from the main road, find my way. There were good maps, so that was not a problem, but I found my way to Pulelia, and as I drove into the village, there was Edmund wearing a very dirty pair of shorts and a dirty t-shirt, and waving, gesticulating to me. So I stopped, and he had literally whitewashed the inside of a cowshed. And he had moved into this cowshed, since there was now no other building that was available in this village. And he was totally surrounded by a group of little brown children who were, you know, getting into everything. And he had a cook and a sort of lean-to where the cooking was prepared. And so we sat at camp chairs and had an extremely animated conversation on, you know, the work he was doing and the excitement of this village and the structure of the village and the organization of the lands and so on. He was full of enthusiasm. I remember this vividly. Then later in the afternoon, the rain stopped, and it was muggy and hot, and all the villagers used to go to the village tank. The villages had these tanks where water was collected for the irrigation of the rice fields. And we went to this village tank, sort of rather like a sizable lake, and the villagers were just standing on the shores and bathing, not going very deep. The water was the color of coffee, dark brown, brownish. Certainly you couldn't see through it. And I, having just come from the Mediterranean, I thought I would take a swim. So I plunged in and swam to the middle of this lake and lay on my back and then swam out. And as I came out, Edmund said, you know, he said, the villagers tell me that there is a crocodile in here. But I don't believe it. And we joked about that and so on. The next morning, they did in fact catch a huge crocodile, which had been lurking in those murky waters. So that was the beginning of my time in
You say in your book that
Ceylon.
You were very impressed by Edmund's energy and fieldwork methods.
I could not have entered into field work without his example. That example of being right in the middle of everything in the village, together with the rest of the people around, this easy relationship with them, was a very vivid example for me. So I immediately found myself a village much larger than his, much more complicated, but I did the same thing. I, having seen the example that it worked, so I went in and got a little hut and established myself and started talking to the people and, you know, improving my language and so on. I found an extremely beautiful village, Teripehe, in Valapane near Nildandahinna was a lovely place in the middle of the mountains, and it was very far away because we thought at that time that it would be easier to analyze more traditional communities if they are relatively isolated. I think that probably was a mistake, actually, but in any case, at that time, that's what we thought. So I found this very isolated place, very far away, and I had to walk for 2 or 3 hours after leaving the car on the main road over the mountains to get into the village. And this had been a village that had been there for a very long time, used as a place of banishment for people during the Kandyan Kingdom, for criminals. But I found it a wonderful place, extremely beautiful, with a lovely climate, and I made many friends there.
It used to have malaria, but by the time you got there, it didn't. Is that right?
Yes, there wasn't. Malaria was more or less under control. Yes, of course there had been. Malaria was a serious problem. We all took, I think it was Paludrin at that time, very carefully. I was very lucky. I never got ill at all. Of course, I was very young. That helps. But it was a very productive and exciting period. But looking back upon the fieldwork, again, I'm struck by our naivete. That is to say, we did not see the great great turmoil, the great hurricane that was going to hit the island with the political problems of the Tamils and the Sinhalese. We really had no idea that this was coming. We were still enjoying the afterglow of the colonial period, in which the colonial administration had kept these tensions under control. And they were there, but they had not come out in their full nastiness as they did later. So from the time we left the island in 1958, 56, 57, things began, the political process began to become more and more ominous. The clouds got darker and darker, and things, relations between people got worse and worse. And so some of the villages where I had been working in eastern Ceylon, where there had been complete merging of the Tamils and the Sinhalese, they had mixed and intermarried for generations, had multiple names, Sinhalese names as well as Tamil names in the family and so on. All those were severely tested as a result of the Tamil-Sinhalese troubles, which have still not subsided, of course. And we really had no sense of this, of this problem coming.
Do you think you didn't have a sense because it was the people themselves didn't have a sense of it? In other words, it wasn't very pronounced, but political events then generated it, as it did in much of Macedonia and Bosnia and so on. Many anthropologists went there and didn't see what was happening.
Yes.
Or do you have a view, a sort of more Freudian view, that it was there all the time, but just repressed, and it was partly your naivety that made it impossible for you to see it?
I think the latter, actually. Yeah. I think we were naive. Yeah. We were naive because it was also because the experience, the colonial experience, had been so thoroughgoing and things had been so well managed. I mean, when I think of the fact that I remember reading somewhere that the whole of Bengal was administered by 2 or 3 Britishers for a very long time. The total number of police in Ceylon when we were there, the total number was something like 15,000 for a population of, what was it at that time, maybe 10, 12 million. that's absolutely minimal numbers. So obviously, things were quiet in terms of political problems and administration. But soon, with elections, with popular representations, with popular leaders whipping up the crowds, things began to move in very ominous directions and have not really ceased being extremely worrying.
Just to finish on your PhD, which presumably was what turned into Under the Bow Tree.
Yes.
Can you summarize the main theme? It seems that a Levi-Straussian attempt to see structural transformations
yes.
of kinship systems, but
yes.
you can summarize it better than I can, I'm sure.
Well, I was... So we were very concerned about the whole question of structures and the structure of consciousness, and I think this is still a very important problem. Levi-Strauss has written about this in very imaginative ways. I think it goes back to the whole question raised by Durkheim of the conscience collective. What is it that makes a conscience collective? Sartre, when he was criticizing Durkheim and Levi-Strauss, said, conscience collective, that's a sort of weird, what are these weird, gooey realities outside the individual? The only thing I can recognize, he wrote, is individual consciousness. I am aware of what I am aware of, and these things outside the individual consciousness, collective consciousness, that's just nonsense. Yet we know full well that there is such a thing as collective consciousness, and the problem is how to understand it and how to analyze it and investigate it. And Levi-Strauss has taken one direction in trying to analyze it by going further and further in the analysis of these mythologies. In any case, we thought that, Edmund Leach and I thought that by investigating the organization and structure of kinship systems, we would be able to understand something about how the mentality and consciousness of the society, as far as kinship systems is concerned, works, and whether there is something orderly in this organization. So that was the first step. And I was very fortunate to find a whole range of variations of kinship systems in Ceylon, which seemed to me parallel to a whole range of variations of kinship systems in South India. I came to this conclusion only after I came back and I finished my PhD. I started working on my PhD to see if I could turn it into something that made sense as a book. And the more I worked on it, the more this matter of patterns of consciousness, which are then manipulated, whereby you can have structures which change into other structures, that whole problem, the intellectual aspect of that problem, became very exciting for me. And I found all of a sudden that these patterns that I had seen from east, from west to east in Sri Lanka, and then from west to east in South India, could be put together in a kind of construct of combinations and permutations. And so intellectually, I think that still makes sense, that there is something there, because the mind, because our minds are organized in to be able to manage complicated things like mathematics, It is clear that societies too manage their relations, particularly if they are traditional and old societies, can have these arrangements in which they have a pattern, and then in order to express difference, the next group changes the pattern slightly. So the whole game of differentiation, difference, turns out to be this manipulation of patterns. And that is really what I found very exciting and interesting, and I wanted to write about. What I have not written enough about is the irrational aspects of this. And I think there is an irrational. Obviously, human consciousness is not entirely rational. There are rational areas, and there are irrational areas. And I will go back to the question of irrationality, which I think turns around all these elaborate systems associated with sacrifice and rituals and other matters of that kind.
You went first to Chicago in...
Well, before we get there, let me say something about Peterhouse.
Yes.
After coming back from Ceylon and having more or less finished the thesis, I was made bifellow of Peterhouse, which was a very happy occasion for me, very exciting. And at that time I had some close friends who were Peter Pauling and Linda Pauling.
This is the famous Pauling family.
This is the famous Pauling family. They had, and Linus Pauling had just, he had gotten one Nobel Prize, and then he'd got another Nobel Prize, and Crick and Watson were working. I was living in the house of Kendrew,
yes.
John Kendrew, who was a fellow of Peterhouse. And it was a very happy time for me to be a fellow of Peterhouse. And I was about 28, 29, and I had not done my military service in Turkey. And my family was getting rather antsy about this, because unless you do your military service, you can't... you might lose your citizenship and so on. And I wasn't prepared to do that. So I went back to Turkey. I had to give up my fellowship at Peterhouse. Everyone was very surprised with all the nice wines and the nice rooms and so on. One doesn't give that sort of up very easily. But I did that, and I spent almost 2 years in the Turkish military, which was fascinating for me. After my field work in Ceylon, this was another bout of field work, essentially, in Turkey with the Kurds, with Arabs, with all sorts of other Turkish groups from the north, with Georgians and so on, all of whom in very intimate surroundings in the military. Quite fascinating. And since I, by that time, I was referred to as a docent, I had very high status, high prestige. And so the military life was rather easy. And it was just about the time when there was a military coup d'etat in Turkey against the elected government of Adnan Menderes. And to watch all of that from very close quarters in the general headquarters in Ankara, where the officers around me were all getting very excited about this event, which had very profound implications for the entire country, was an experience that I found very important. I was also fortunate because the president then, the military person who became the president, General Gürsel, had heard about me. So he invited me to go to the presidential palace and asked me to set up a planning board for the country. Imagine being given a task like that at the age of 30, very heady stuff. So I got together some of my friends from the universities there, and we set up this the legal arrangements for this board and got it passed through the provisional parliament and so on. But I decided that if I stayed in that line, I was obviously going to be drawn further and further into politics. And I really didn't like the idea of military politics. I didn't like the kind of implications that this had. And so I said to my friends in the planning board, I'm not going to go on with this. I'm going to go back to academic life. And Edmund at that time was going to California, to the Center for Behavioral Studies in California. So he arranged the center to extend an invitation to me as well. So I got this invitation, this was 1960, fall 1960, from California, where Roman Jakobson was going to be present as well. So the attractions of having Edmund, Roman Jakobson, in California in this beautiful climate, and I was having troubles with my first wife, my Turkish wife, who the marriage was not going too well. I thought this was just the right time to make a break. And so I said to her, come with me, if you like, to America. She said, no, I will stay here. So I went to California and liked it. I thought California was a wonderful, beautiful place and so open and so in its own way in the 1960s still so naive and innocent as far as the ways of the old world is concerned, and a tremendous sense of optimism towards the future. And so Edmund and Roman Jakobson and I had a really quite wonderful time at the center, talking about our theories about symbolism, about language, the significance of language, the symbolic aspects of language, and that was a very lively period for me. And then the American universities started getting interested in my staying there, and I got an offer from Chicago, which was to the effect that I could have 6 months teaching and 6 months free. And I thought this was very nice, so I accepted that and joined the University of Chicago after the period in Stanford. Edmund wanted me to come back to Cambridge, and he was, I think, somewhat unhappy that I stayed in Chicago. He wanted us to work, to continue to work together here. But I found that at the time there was a great deal of interest in America in Turkey as well. So the combination of the interests in the universities in the Middle East, and I'd just been involved in this heady adventure in Turkey, and made it so that I could see there were many other aspects in American academic life which would be interesting to me. So with a sense of considerable regret, I decided that I would stay there rather than return to Cambridge.
Are you mainly known in America as a Turkish expert or a Sri Lankan expert?
Well, I think they probably don't know quite where to put me, because I have really very profound interests in India and Sri Lanka, and since then I have also developed further interests in Southeast Asia, in Indonesia, Thailand, and of course Japan. But I have been, I was the director of the Middle East Center at Chicago for 4 years, where I put together quite an interesting team of people. One of them was this man that Jack was mentioning yesterday, Halil İnalcık, the historian of the Ottoman Empire. Another one was Professor Fahir İz, a professor of the history of literature, Ottoman literature. A third one was Alexander Bennigsen, a specialist on Central Asia, the Turks of Central Asia. So I was able to put together quite an interesting group there. And working there, I also traveled quite a bit in the various Middle Eastern countries. I had already had very close contacts with Iran. The father of my first wife had offices in Tehran, Baghdad, Beirut, and Cairo. Also mistresses in all these cities. But so I had visited him in Tehran. He was a very lively and wonderful man. And so I knew quite a bit about the Middle East. And so being the director of the Middle East Center was an interesting experience. You're right. There is that aspect of me was the one that the Americans were more interested in, because at that time there wasn't a great deal of interest in Ceylon.
And then your contemporaries at Chicago were obviously some very distinguished Indologists. Was McKim Marriott there?
Yes, Kim Marriott was there. Ed Cohn.
Yes, Barney Cohn.
Barney Cohn.
Ron Inden, was he there?
Ron Inden was a graduate student and then stayed on there, yes.
And of course other great figures like Marshall Sahlins.
Of course, Marshall Sahlins came after me.
Did he?
Yes.
Do you know him at all?
I don't know him personally terribly well, no. I know his work, but I had left Chicago by then.
So why did you leave? You were headhunted again, were you?
Yes. I didn't like the life in the Midwest. Mm. I am a person who likes living by the sea. Mm. And the lake, the Great Michigan Lake, was not very appealing. Mm. And I found Dennis McSmith came to visit me in Chicago, because at the time he'd been working on the Sicilian Mafia. Mm. And he thought he should take a look at the Mafia around Chicago. And he took one look at the surroundings of the city, and at that time there was a great deal of violence still. It is still rather violent. There are still serious social problems in Chicago. And he said, life here is just grim, too grim for words. And I can see what he means, you know, after Cambridge, England. Chicago, Illinois is an uphill struggle because of the sense of alienation of large sections of the population. And so I thought, by that time I had a young family. And when Harvard came along to invite me to join them, I thought it would probably be more attractive living in Boston. And it has turned out to be so. Boston and Cambridge are very attractive places, and we have enjoyed living there. And I have brought up my three younger children in Boston.
Well, I'm hoping this is the first of many interviews I'll have with you, because there are so many other things to talk about. Is there any sort of particular last thing that you would like to say to the camera?
I think the problem of rationality and irrationality is really the key to a lot of our work. And I am very interested in this whole matter of the rational aspects of our consciousness, the structured, organized aspects of our consciousness, as opposed to those dark forces that Freud wrote about. And I think that we still are struggling with those matters. There is the whole area of politics, of course, but the issue of the nature of the conscience collective, the inner structuring of the conscience collective, I think, remains a challenge for us for the future.
We'll work on it together. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.